Welcome to the Drunk Guys Book Club, where books aren't just for school, book clubs aren't just for women, and beer makes everything better. I'm Mike.
I'm Nate.
And we're the Drunk Guys, and this week we are talking about Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers.
Outliers. Probably his most famous, although not his first, for sure. Probably his most famous, and our first non-fiction book on the podcast.
Yeah, look at that. We are branching out in the world. So, Outliers has a subtitle, right? It's the story of success, right? He has a bunch of case studies, essentially, looking at different people or groups of people who have been wildly successful in various fields and tries to explain what led to their success. Mm-hmm. So if I were to summarize his argument, because it's nonfiction, I don't need to give you the plot, I'll give you his argument. The argument is that your success is not 100% your own. If you have been successful, it is because of many factors, both within and largely without your control.
Your hard work, definitely an important factor, but also when you were born, the circumstances in which you were born, the circumstances in which you made a name for yourself or you worked hard, whatever field you were in, if you had all those factors put together, that's what led to your success.
With that in mind, we're going to open our first beer, which is Lagunitas Little Something Something Ale, because to be successful, you need at the very least a little something something.
Definitely.
In Malcolm Gladwell's world. Here you go, sir. Cheers.
Thank you.
Little Something Something is an unlimited release from Lagunitas. It is a 7.5% alcohol ale. It has a whole bunch of like weird stuff written around the label here, but I'm just going to pour it out and drink it. It is a nice sort of golden color, strawish golden color. Nice frothy white head. Nice, tastes like a nice
that's good.
IPA, you know? Bitter, floral, fruity, hoppy smell. It's delicious. I've had quite a few of these in my day, I must say.
I've had quite a few as well.
This is one of those beers you could almost always find when you're at a bar in Brooklyn or Manhattan or Queens, hips, at least the hip parts of Queens.
Probably most of the country.
Yeah, it is a big, I mean, they're from California. I think Lagunitas was fairly recently purchased by a large company.
Mm.
So real
beer.
Might have been InBev.
Hopefully not. Budweiser and Lagunitas? That would be bad.
So, on the same cruise where I was embarrassed by my lack of Harry Potter knowledge, and I drank as
couple
much as
podcasts
I wanted to,
yeah.
The one beer they had on the ship that I liked was Lagunitas Little Something Something Ale. And, you know, they have other beers. I just don't like Budweiser. I don't like Heineken. I don't like Coors. So I really didn't want to drink. If I'm going to drink something, I want to drink something I like. They had a Little Something Something. Or Sam Adams. And I like Sam Adams too, but a little something something I prefer a little bit more than Boston Lager. So I drank virtually everyone on the ship in the 9-day cruise. There were entire bars on the ship that they're like, oh, we don't have any more of those. I'm like, what do you mean you don't have any more? I pay for unlimited all-inclusive drinks, damn it. Like, you have to go to the bar on the other floor. It's like they throttled my beer consumption.
They might have.
So I have had a lot of little something something. It is an old friend. It is a delicious, wonderful beer.
And if Lagunitas wanted to sponsor us, please do.
Yeah, please. I mean, if any cruise line wants to start us.
That too.
So the most famous thing in Malcolm Gladwell's book, you know, it argues about these different factors that result in success for the hyper-successful.
Mm-hmm.
He's not looking at like people who managed to lose 10 pounds on their diet at January 1st plan. He's talking about people who are the pinnacle of whatever field they're in. How did they get there? And the most famous part from this book is the 10,000-hour rule. An idea he didn't even invent, as far as I know.
Nope.
He kind of collected this from somewhere. How does the 10,000-hour rule work?
So the idea is, if you're trying to learn a skill, whether it's learning a musical instrument, whether it's playing chess, whether it's some like really complex human behavior.
Sports.
A sport would also qualify. In order to be an expert, be a world expert in something, it's going to take about 10,000 hours of practice. That's the rule. What he does is he goes through a couple of really key examples of how you get 10,000 hours.
Do the math on that, right? So if I were to do an hour a day, how many years would it take for me to get to 10,000 hours?
It's a lot, because what he says in the book is it's roughly 20 hours a week for 10 years.
Well,
that's how you get to 10,000 hours. So you have to do 3 hours a day.
Well, if I do 1 hour a day religiously, which is a shit ton of
time. So it's 30 years.
It's 27 and a third.
Yeah, so like it's almost 3 decades. If you did 1 hour a day of practice at something, it would take you 3 decades to get to 10,000 hours. So really, that's a lot. And if you wanted to be an expert at something by the time you're a young adult, you know, you couldn't just do 1 hour a day. You would have to do a lot more.
Well, I hate to break it to you, but I've done 10,000 hours of practice or something.
Drinking?
No. I am but a Padawan. But I could masturbate better than at this point in my life.
You've done 10,000 hours of practice?
Easily. So if I discovered it when I was 13, by the time I was 13, I had done 10,000 hours. It's pretty sweet. So right, I have gotten that down to a science. I'm still looking for a way to turn that into a career and life-changing move. But if you have ideas, tweet us at DrunkGuysBC, hashtag SpankingTheMonkey, and I'll let you know how that works out. But in realistically, there are things we do. Like, what are things that you spend a lot, that you like to work at and practice that you spend a lot of time on?
I mean, the best example is learning a musical instrument.
It seems the simplest.
Yeah.
Because it's just time on task. Have you held your violin for 10,000 hours? But even that's not quite enough, right?
No.
Because there are people who are old as dirt. Take, for example, Willie Nelson. Willie Nelson's like 84 years old. He has been playing the guitar for 60-plus years.
He smoked pot for 10,000 hours.
Oh, he can.
For sure.
Yes,
for 20,000 hours. No problem.
He could. That's true. That he is an expert at. He is the Yoda of that. But could he play the guitar better than anyone? No, not even close. Now, I like Willie Nelson's music, and not just that. I actually like, I've listened to a lot of Willie Nelson music, and I don't fuck any of my cousins, so I legitimately like it.
He's played EADG for probably 20,000 hours as well.
Don't forget C.
And C, you're right.
He is
A minor?
Yeah.
Probably E minor as well.
You get caged with the upper and lowercase vowels. You're set.
Mm-hmm.
He's played a shit ton of songs. If you just tally up how many concerts he's played. So the 10,000 hour thing is a little nebulous because he's probably done 10,000 hours of holding a guitar, singing, and playing in front of people. Does that make Willie Nelson the greatest performer of all time? That's debatable because that's the sort of thing that, what does that even mean? But just in terms of guitar playing, is Willie Nelson going to outplay Van Halen or Slash even? I like Slash and Guns N' Roses and stuff, but he's like not even close to the greatest guitar player. Mm-hmm. He's probably the most famous Greek guitar player. No, because time on
task. Who's not dead?
Hey, Van Halen's alive. I mean, and then you got all those Shredder guys. So both Nate and I play the guitar.
Yes.
To varying degrees of nerdery.
We're going to talk a lot about playing guitar on this podcast.
That's the lens we could see it through today because we're just not there yet for drinking the beers. But we're working on it. You think of your super, you know, the stuff that only guitar nerds know about, or people who are on the tangent of guitar nerd, like Steve Vai and Joe Satriani, who I fucking love and worship, especially when I was 15 years old. When I wasn't masturbating.
For those brief minutes.
It's just when I recovered, I had time to hear one song. It would be Steve Vai. Oh, yeah, this song's great. Just fucked up. Because you would think I've conditioned myself to associate Steve Vai with jerking off. But I haven't somehow. So take that, Skinner.
Well, maybe that's why you like Steve Vai so much.
That's why I get off. It's a raging erection whenever I listen to Joe Satriani. But those guys are a different kind of guitar player than Willie Nelson is. And he's lived a shitload longer than them. He has, I would imagine, has spent more time holding a guitar and performing in front of people than them. But it's a little more complex than just 10,000 mm-hmm. hours of playing. It is conscious practice.
Yeah.
And goal-oriented practice, which is very different than what most of us do when we are practicing something.
Yeah. It involves probably having a teacher who's also an expert who can tell you, this is what you need to work on. This is the thing you need to practice. These are the things you need to spend many hours on. And if you don't have a teacher, it's probably a lot harder to become an expert after 10,000 hours than just doing it on your own. Not impossible, but much harder.
There are very few in any field autodidacts who are amazing experts. And you never hear the word autodidact, which is fancy and sounds smart.
And means what?
It means self-taught.
Oh, there you go.
You only hear that word for fucking weird people. So I just talked about Steve Vai and Joe Satriani, but I learned that word back in high school when I was reading about Frank Zappa. Frank Zappa is an autodidact music composer. I don't really like his fucking music. Now, he taught himself and made his own weird thing. So his 10,000 hours, if he ever got to the 10,000 hours, were spent very differently than if somebody had taken composition lessons with, whatever composer, and Stravinsky was alive at his time, and maybe he took lessons with John Adams and Steve Reich and whoever. Having guided practice whether externally from a teacher mm-hmm. or internally just because you are intuitive into what you want to improve on, will result in very different things than just, I'm going to go dick around on the guitar, or I'm going to dick around on the baseball field throwing a ball for 10,000 hours. That will not make you an expert.
No.
Are we shortchanging Gladwell? Are we, like, being shitty?
So here's the thing about this book. You know, I read it when it came out, and then I reread it in this past week to preparing for the podcast. And it is fascinating. It is so interesting. Gladwell does such a good job telling you the story and telling you about what happens and why this is important and why this thing leads to that thing. And it is so fascinating. And when I reread it this time, I definitely reread it with the mind of, okay, well, where is he wrong? You know, where what is he mistaken about? What can I argue about? There are some things I can definitely argue about, but it was still incredibly interesting. But here's the thing about the 10,000-hour rule, as we're getting at. It is more complex than just you need to practice the same thing for 10,000 hours. It is way more complicated than that. So this is chapter two. So this is like the very beginning of the book. Chapter two, we're talking about music, kids in music school, music college, you know, not just, you know, middle school, but definitely in college. How many hours they've spent as practice, and the kids that the students who are at the top did around 10,000 hours. The kids that were like sort of in the middle or the bottom did, you know, 4, 5, 6 thousand hours. And that really, there's no impact of talent. It's almost like the people who did the study didn't actually find any impact of talent ever. Like the people who were at the top did around 10,000 hours. People at the bottom did not. And there's nothing in between. Nobody was so talented that they got to be so good without that amount of practice.
It's like you need a little something extra.
You
like.
Need a little something extra.
Which brings us to our next beer.
That beer number two. Which...
from the Lagunitas Brewing Company, which we might have mentioned today, they have a different beer called Little Something Extra, which is basically Little Something with every quality of the beer.
A little bit extra.
Put up a little bit. Taken up another notch. So whereas Little Something was 7.5% alcohol, this is 8.7%. And whereas Little Something was 64.2 IBUs, which, by the way, we've used that term. If you don't know what an IBU is, I realize we've said that in many episodes. IBUs are international bittering units. Mm-hmm. They're just a way of measuring how bitter the flavor of the beer is. And you calculate that by measuring the type of hops, the quantity of the hops, and how bitter they are. So 64.2 IBUs is fairly bitter. Yeah. I think I remember reading somewhere that at about 120 IBUs versus 130 IBUs, you cannot tell the difference.
Yeah, somewhere a little bit past 100, maybe 120, you can't, your taste buds cannot taste the difference anymore. So if you were to look for a 1,000 IBU beer, which totally exists.
I've had it.
I think I've had that too. Like you can't really taste the difference between a, say, 120 IBU beer and 1,000 IBU beer because we just can't do it.
As humans. I remember very vividly.
We need it.
Mikkeller, 1,000 IBU. Mikkeller is this brewery sort of out of Denmark. It's another gypsy brewery where they don't really have mm-hmm. set place. And in fact, I believe it's the twin brother of the guy who runs Evil Twin Brewing, which is very interesting.
So he's the good twin?
I guess so. Though actually, I must admit, I prefer Evil Twin's beers. Maybe just because they're cheaper and easier to find. But they had a beer called 1,000 IBUs. I bought years and years ago when I was really first getting into beer. And I was psyched about it because I loved IPAs at the time. My favorite beer at the time. And quite possibly to this day, my favorite IPA was Dogfish Head 90 Minute, which is like 100 IBUs. It's like, that's 100. What's 1,000 like? And it really pretty much just tasted like Dogfish Head 90.
Yeah.
But I haven't had it many years, and maybe my palate's sharper now, and I don't know if they even still make that beer. But if Mikkeller wants to send us a bottle, I'll try it, and I'll eat my hat when it tastes better. So Gladwell's argument, kind of, especially the thing about musical talent, makes you question if talent is even a thing to begin with.
So this is chapter two of the book, and he really kind of said, he says, talent really isn't a thing, at least for really good musicians. Like, the people who are the best, they just practice more. And so his argument is that talent really isn't a thing. And then in every other chapter of the book, he says, oh, well, if you work hard and have talent and are born at the right time, born in the right year, then you can go places. But one criticism I have of the book is that he talks about talent not being a thing in the very beginning and then talks about talent for much of the rest of the book.
Yeah, he talks in the various examples, which we'll get to, he seems to say that. I think just because I know a little bit about music, which full disclosure, I guess, I went to school for music. I have an undergraduate degree in music. Not that I am in any way that good, but I've seen at least a glimpse into the world he's describing. And I think it's far more complicated than to say, oh, you practice for 10,000 hours. I think that's the sort of thing a person who's never held a musical instrument would say.
That's it. It's just 10,000 hours, no other.
And
no
now,
other consideration.
I don't know fucking dick about playing sports, but I bet...
Or chess.
Oh, God, no. But I bet, you know what, actually, chess might be a simpler example because there's less physical exercise required for chess. You know, mm-hmm. if I wanted to be the best baseball player and I want to be the best third baseman who hits the most home runs, there's a lot of physical things I need to be able to do.
Well, that's Ted Williams.
Well, Ted Williams. Is his head also frozen somewhere?
might be.
I think it is.
Even Walt Disney.
There's a physical thing you have to do. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to be able to produce this amount of force, which can only be achieved through perhaps a combination of physical innate ability by being big and having large limbs and getting that leverage, being tall, being able to be flexible, but also strong from whether it's lifting weights or repeating this motion over and over again and working at it. Chess doesn't have any of that. Chess is purely mental, which is why I think a lot of people are totally scared of chess because you say, like, oh, I'm bad at chess, I'm just stupid, is what you think. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of a thing embedded throughout that I thought about reading this whole book. Is like, so if you're just encouraged at the right time, you might be able to do something. Whereas if you don't get that encouragement, you just kind of say, that's not for me.
That's over. I won't do that.
Yeah, I remember playing chess as a kid, and I was got my pants beaten off of me by my uncle. Not taken off of me by my uncle. That's a different kind of story. Didn't happen this time.
You weren't beaten off by an uncle.
I did not have my pants taken off, and I was not beaten off by my uncle. But I lost at chess to him.
End of that. End of that pursuit.
And this sucked. And he actually was really kind and patient with me. He was trying to teach me. But because I was discouraged, I felt discouraged. I'm like, you know what? I don't really. It's cool. I don't need to do that. So that might be a personal thing. And I think that's really a big part of what talent is. I shouldn't deny that there are people who are talented. There are people who pick up an instrument, who pick up a football, who do whatever.
Pick up a chessboard.
And they somehow can do it. They intuit it. They get there quickly. That exists. However, not every expert started there.
No.
I think what every expert and those talented people have in common is that they had discipline and tenacity, and they stuck with it. So I think of, I see things through the lens of music in this case. I think of musicians, and I think of guitar players in particular, because that's the instrument I play. And I think of guitar players who are like, I spent, months just playing these chords, and then I learned these things, and then I moved on to these harder chords, and then I learned this scale and whatever. That takes time and patience to learn that kind of thing. And you need to stick with that. And every time you take one baby step further in on your path of development, there's the chance for you to go, this wasn't easy. I don't really need to know how to do that. I'll go back to playing Glen Campbell songs. But you can't play Glen Campbell songs. At least Glen Campbell can't play Glen Campbell songs because he's a Tombstone Cowboy. Sorry, too soon? He died a month ago. But we're recording it.
Definitely a month ago. Not today.
Poor Glen Campbell. Yeah. Well, that's all right. All right. By the time he gets to heaven, I'm sorry. This isn't about Glen Campbell, but all right. What was it? Guitar. All right. I'm Galvis done. Just like Glen Campbell is. So you take these little steps, and there's every step for you to go like, fuck this. This is hard. I don't like this. This hurts my hand. This is frustrating. This doesn't sound good. This is shitty. And then you retract. Now, some people might do that and then branch out somewhere else, you know, because the instrument of the guitar or any other instrument, you might say, you know what, maybe I'm not going to be playing Eddie Van Halen shredder shit, but I'm going to go play Chet Atkins fingerstyle guitar. Totally different beast, virtually different instruments at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you have to force yourself down those different roads. That's where talent really comes in for music for me, that you have
the talent is the discipline. The talent isn't, I'm really good at this instrument or I'm really good at music. The talent is almost, I'm so disciplined, I can make myself practice. I can make myself learn these things. I can make myself go this step further. And I have the good teachers that can tell me what I need to do when I need to practice for my next 1,000 hours.
Right. And I think that applies to other fields, too. I think it applies, take it to the sports world.
Mm-hmm.
Something I don't say guilty pleasure because I feel no guilt. But I watch the World's Strongest Man competition every year. I'm fascinated by it. Because I watch these giant mountain-shaped men lift heavy things because they can. And then the competition is not just, hey, could you lift 2 refrigerators on a yoke and walk? It's, did you do it faster than the other guy? That's fascinating to me because it's so ridiculous, but they're so fantastic at it that it's fun to watch. Those guys have the same thing. The majority of those guys have a natural ability. They're fucking big dudes. They're all tall and broad and have hands that are really big and legs that are really like really thick joints. They could support more muscle growth. But they also spent hours and hours and hours lifting fucking heavy shit. Whether that was lifting cement balls or, which is a fucking thing. If you've ever watched it, it's called the Atlas Stones. Super cool. I would love to try them, but like, they don't make them. I need like basically an Atlas ball the size of a cantaloupe that I can lift. But they're lifting like 400-pound cement balls and just to put them over a little beam and then drop it. That's what they do.
Or such as Hafþór Bjornsson, who plays The Mountain, which you said a couple minutes ago, who plays The Mountain on Game of Thrones, you know, was you know, a contestant in World's Strongest Man.
He is a year or two ago.
He is 7 feet tall, or 6 foot
he's
10, like, or something
like
that. He's really tall.
And he's like 400 pounds, but he has a six pack.
He's 6 foot nine, and incredibly strong. Like, you have to be genetically, you're not going to be 6 foot nine unless you have the genetics to be 6 foot nine.
Right.
But then you have to fucking lift weights.
Like
lift,
a motherfucker.
And lift balls for 10,000 hours in order to get that physique.
You don't have to suck balls.
Just lift them.
Unless you want to.
That's okay, too.
That's okay. But he's we're getting way off topic, but I saw a picture of that dude standing next to Magnus Vermagnussen, which is the greatest fucking name, who is a guy who won World's Strongest Man four times in the 90s. Big Icelandic guy who's like, I don't know, 6'2 or 6'3 or something like that, which is how fucking tall I am.
Yeah.
Like, I'm a big dude in most circles of friends.
I am not that tall.
That's fine. Nobody's perfect. So I usually am the biggest guy in the crowd. And that's fine. I do take it. I will admit some shred of pride in that. Not that I had any say in it. But I see the picture of Magnus Vermagnussen, fucking behemoth man, who lifted, you know, who would lift 500 pounds above his head sort of guy. And he is dwarfed by that dude from Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Like, it looks like an older brother and his kid brother. It's ridiculous. And then it's humbling for me to see that man be humbled. And that does tell you about there is a genetic component. So if you bring it back to music, 10,000 hours, playing guitar. If you don't have fucking hands playing guitar, it's a problem. If you have hands that have really long, spindly spider fingers that you could reach really far, you have a leg up.
Yeah.
If you have...
It's not the deciding factor.
No, it's not.
You have a leg up.
But there is such a thing as talent, because if you have that, if you have perfect pitch, which is the fairly rare ability or absolute pitch, it's called, to just know a musical note. Like if somebody just sings a note.
D-flat.
Yeah. Oh, A sharp. Boom. I don't know why anyone would say A sharp. It could be flat. But you have these things, and you could just pull it out of thin air, and you could produce it. They say, hey, can you sing me a C? And you go, which I think is close to C, but it's probably not really. But you do that. That is a thing you cannot learn. That is somehow, unless you, there's actually...
Well, you can learn it, but there are people who can do it innately without the kind of training or 10,000 hours of practice that everybody else needs. There are people who are extra talented like that.
And then there's other elements of performing on music instruments, like being able to memorize music, being able to read music quickly and interpret that and translate that. All of those things are smaller skills in the overall skill of being a musician. Each one of those things a person might be better at innately than another. So I think there's such a thing as talent in music at the very least. In sports, I'm sure too, right? Being faster, being more explosive in your strength, having longer arms or whatever.
Not that we here on the podcast know anything about talent in sports.
Or music for that matter. Otherwise this would be Mike's Bluegrass Hour or whatever the fuck. Mike Shredder Hoedown. Much like everything else in the book. Much like everything else in our podcast. Oversimplifies it.
Yep.
And if I could add one other thing, he's got a fucking awful wrong example in this book.
Which was?
So, the other thing that I spent a lot of time studying was the Beatles.
Right.
Because I fucking love the Beatles. And I wrote some papers on the Beatles in grad school. Because that's what you can get away with when you're getting a stupid degree. And he gives the Beatles as the example of the 10,000 hour rule.
Yeah.
So he gives it in the example of the Beatles spent 6 hours a night playing in shitty, dingy clubs in Hamburg for a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do 6, 7, 8 hours a night every day plus your band's recording sessions, brand practice sessions, plus the years leading up to this, by the time the Beatles broke on the Ed Sullivan Show in February of 1964, they had their 10,000 hours.
So he doesn't actually say they had 10,000 hours.
All right, fine. But
what
he
says is, after doing that for like 2 years, two to three years, however long it was, after playing 6 to 7 to 8 hours a night, every 7 nights a week, that they were much better, that they were much more together. They knew a ton more songs. I mean, I think it's definitely true that they were much better after 2 or 3 years of playing 8 hours a day. I mean, I think everybody would. But it's funny that that's the next example in the chapter of the 10,000-hour rule, because that's not 10,000 hours. It isn't.
That's true. But that's, more importantly, that's not why the Beatles are famous.
No.
The Beatles stopped touring after, like, June of 1966.
Yeah.
Beatles are infinitely fascinating because they are, in every metric, the greatest band who's ever lived. Or ever existed, I should say. And I will fight you if you disagree. They are awesome. But they exist from 1964 to 1970, or so, the years they released records.
Mm-hmm.
You want to go back a little earlier, 1962. You want to include Ringo in there, and you want to get their, like, actual format. Fuck Pete Best. And you want to have Paul on the bass, so you forget about that Stu Sutcliff guy who died and quit the band. So they got six to eight years of Beatles. They are not famous for being a performing band. They are famous for writing songs.
Yeah.
That's what makes the Beatles different than most of their contemporaries. That Paul McCartney and John Lennon, with a little help from their friends, George Harrison.
A couple of George Harrison songs.
Which he wrote some good ones. And a couple pieces of shit from Ringo. They wrote their own tunes. They did sing. They sang harmony. They all played a bunch of instruments. They wrote and recorded interesting new music. That is not what Malcolm Gladwell gives as the example.
Because
when they were playing at Hamburg, they were playing covers.
Yeah.
They were playing shit from The Music Man and crap like that. They were playing things that crowds wanted to hear.
And their earliest songs that you could sort of guess that they might have been working on or writing during that period when they were playing in Hamburg for strip clubs in Hamburg, they're really, really simple.
Right.
Like Love Me Do. You know, that's so simple. It's like, that is not the kind of thing you would look at and say, oh yeah, that's definitely a 10,000 hours of practice needed to go into that song.
Right. 10,000 hours to go from Love Me Do to A Day in the Life.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bad example. I think the Beatles, now, as you get into the question there, though, 10,000 hours of specific directed practice, I would say Paul, to some degree, you might be right, because Paul McCartney, John Lennon, George Harrison, Ringo, they were listening to music constantly,
mm-hmm.
and thinking about music and writing songs, and that might have provided them the feedback to get better. That might have helped them to improve as songwriters. But that's nowhere close to 10,000 hours.
Is that why all the Paul McCartney songs after he left the Beatles are terrible?
Not all, man. But 99%.
A lot of them. Most of them.
Virtually all of them, yes. Well, there was a thing in The Atlantic maybe a year or two ago about how maybe the thing that really helped the Beatles be successful was the competition between John and Paul.
I think that's true.
Right, because they are listed as the co-songwriters on the majority of their hits, unless it was George Harrison, or if you're a real Beatles nerd, you will know the songs that Ringo co-wrote or wrote, and you could tweet those to us at DrunkGuysBC.
I do not know what those are.
I know them, because I'm ready. Whenever I'm on Jeopardy and obscure Beatles trivia is a category, I am going to clean house. So
I think, in terms of the Beatles, I think Paul McCartney needed John Lennon's input. It needed John Lennon's, because once Paul McCartney left the Beatles, there was nobody who could say, no, that's shit.
Sure.
Don't do that. That is terrible. This little part of the song, that is awful. He needed John Lennon to say, no, don't do that. Do this instead.
We're simply not having a wonderful Christmas time, Paul. Shut the fuck up.
It's not your birthday.
That's a Beatles song. That's from the White Album.
That's my joke, yeah. Hey, it's not your birthday today. Shut the fuck up. Let's go back to Day in the Life.
Well, but then John had Yoko providing all sorts of constructive feedback. And look how that worked out. And she was like, hey, let's move into the Dakota right before that crazy guy is.
Yeah, that's... Good move.
Terrible. Terrible.
Good move. Hey, let's read Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah, let's give copies to the schizophrenic, crazy people on the street. So the 10,000 hour rule, you know what, though? At the end of the day, I don't discount it. I think that there's validity to it. I just think it's a little more, not a little more, it's a lot more complex than Gladwell makes it out.
Yeah.
Because if I wanted to be the best, you know, at this point, as we're in our 30s now, if I wanted to be an expert at something, and I say, I'm going to take the lessons from Outliers, and I'm going to spend 10,000 hours on it, I might have a good shot at doing it. Just because I would think more about what it takes to be an expert at that thing. So if I want to be the best guitar player, it's like, oh, well, I'm going to learn my fucking physical things, the scales and whatever. I'm going to learn the different guitar techniques. I'm going to listen to lots of guitar recordings and all that. I could do that. But it doesn't work for lots of other things. Like, the best songwriter? How do you be the best songwriter in 10,000 hours?
How do you even judge that?
I could write lots of shitty songs. I could be the Wesley Willis of our time. Which, if you don't know who Wesley Willis is, please look him up and have yourself a good afternoon, because he is the Mozart of our times. He's a guy who wrote over 1,000 songs. They are virtually interchangeable. And if you have the puerile sense of humor that we have, it's extremely entertaining. So the 10,000 hour rule, more complicated. Talent, that's also more complicated. I think talent's real.
I'm not so sure it is.
You're telling me there aren't people who just are good at something from the start? You never met somebody who can just do something better than other people because it just fits their combination of physical and mental skills?
I mean, besides some, like, physical things, I don't know.
Oh, look at the time it is. It's time for another round.
Oh, you opened another one for me?
Looks like you need a little something more, yeah.
A little something extra.
A little something.
Okay.
I wish we had. You know what? I gotta say, comparing the two, it is subtle. Well, not really subtle, but They are in the same family, those two beers.
Yeah.
A little something, something delicious, awesome IPA, a little something extra. It's not quite Imperial IPA territory, because only 8.5% or so.
Mm-hmm.
It is great, though. 8.7, excuse me. It is a great beer. The difference I noticed with that is more about, like, body. It's a little thicker, it's a little... Everything's amplified, as the name implies.
It's just a little bit more, yeah.
But a little something is a great beer. And I love on the side, if you look at the side of the bottles, little something something says unlimited release. But like the un is, looks like, yeah, it's obviously printed, but it makes it look like it was handwritten. And little something extra is a limited release. I've never seen that before, so I hope they don't put that away. That's really good. So we can keep going on and on about the Beatles and music. Ultimately, I don't disagree with Gladwell. I just think he is missing some nuance here.
You know, that's the thing with the whole book, you know, because there's not just the section about the Beatles. There are multiple different sections of the book. And as you read it, it's so fascinating. And as you read it, you think you're so smart now that you know this stuff. Like, oh, I'm going to conquer the world now that I know that the Beatles got 10,000 hours of practice. But not really. You feel so smart reading it, but after you think about it a bit and read some other people's articles or some other criticism, you realize real life is much more complicated. It's not just that. It's not just 10,000 hours. It's much more. And this is still the first part of the book. We haven't even gotten into the Hatfields and McCoys. We haven't even gotten into growing rice in China. We haven't even gotten into crashing an airplane. I mean, there are many other parts of this book.
I'll say, with the exception of crashing an airplane, these other sections just don't sound as sexy or are as marketable as 10,000 hours. There's a reason why the 10,000 hour rule is so famous, because it's so succinct.
Yeah.
Just say, hell, you want to be great at something? Go do it for 10,000 hours. Because it's almost like saying to someone, I dare you to do it for 10,000 hours, because nobody will, except for people who are really great, because they're already on their way. But there are other things in the book. So the first, you know, we're really jumping around the book. 10,000 hour rules. Chapter 2. Chapter 1 is about the hockey players, and that they're all born virtually between January and March. So his argument is that being born at the right time makes you predisposed for success?
It's not just Chapter 1. So Chapter 1 is, you know, if you're a hockey player, because the cutoff for the next year is January 1st, if you are born, you know, in January, you're going to be 11 months older than the kids born in December. So you're going to be bigger, stronger, faster than those kids. So therefore, you're going to get into the more elite leagues. You're going to have more. You're going to be better at the game, and so you're going to have more teachers. You're going to get more. You're going to get more time on the ice, and so therefore, that's why if you look at the whatever the World NHL. Series of Hockey, the NHL, whatever the World Series of Hockey is, I don't know.
The Stanley Cup.
Yeah, this Stanley Cup, because I'm a fucking idiot. I'm not part Canadian, I swear. If you're a Stanley Cup of Hockey, that's why most of the players were born in January, February, or March. February.
I like January.
That's my favorite month.
January,
February, or March. It's because when they were 5 years old, they were put in the right league because they were a little bit bigger than the other kids, and so they got more attention, they got more training, they got more teaching, and that's what made them more successful, or at least that put them on the path of more training, more everything.
Well, it put them on the path of having success sooner.
Yeah,
and I think that's the big issue. You have reward.
More encouragement.
Yeah, when you have incentive to stay at something, and what is a greater incentive than success? Oh, you're good at this. Keep doing it. For little kids especially, that is
story.
A powerful, yeah. powerful motivator. I wonder, easy way to challenge or to confirm or whatever this theory, what's the success rate for kids in grade school? Because whenever every school I went to, the cutoff was January 1st.
Yeah.
But why doesn't Gladwell cite any of this? There must be data out there. Or is it just that the NHL is really sexy? Because like, oh, if your kid's born in February, fuck Leap Day, that kid's going to be in the NHL. I think, again, it's oversimplifying. And he does explain it. It's about getting the encouragement and the opportunity. But being born in the right time is unfortunate as an example to give about success. Because if there's one thing you absolutely cannot control, it's when you're born. I didn't choose to leave my dad's balls. And here I am, and then I was born the day I was born, and actually, especially, I would imagine, increasingly as time moves on, your birthday, not that it will vary by months, but by days, is determined by the schedule of the doctor and the schedule of your mother and when they want to, you know, how many people are born with a cesarean section.
After 10,000 hours of podcasting, maybe we'll be experts at it.
That's right. Well, with your help, you follow us. On Twitter at DrunkGuysBC, or send us an email at
DrunkGuysBookClub@gmail.com.
You might keep us going around to get to that point. But next week, we're going to do another book. We're going to go return to the world of fiction. We're going to go to the wildly popular sci-fi book, Ready Player One.
Ready Player One.
See you then.
All right. Thanks, everybody.